roast is very oversold at the moment, you know, in the nicest possible way. You know, they may be really happy with their tiny business. It may be making a lot of money, you know, but we've got to grow because it's the thing to do, and that's clever. And, you know, it's not necessarily.
Welcome to the Leadership Junkies podcast, brought to you by Cartavera, the leadership development ecosystem that helps you grow your people, grow your business, and grow your life. We're here today with Jan Cavell, coming to us from the UK. This is episode 123, Get Ready to Scale, Growing Your Leadership and Your Business. Jan Cavell has been building businesses, her own and those of the people she worked with, for decades, and particularly focusing on some key questions, those questions we need to ask and answer as entrepreneurs, both early in the journey and throughout the journey. Jan's going to share so many ideas with us about strategies for growth, strategies for scaling, and what's the difference, some of the key gaps that entrepreneurs struggle with both early and throughout their business journey. And more importantly, she's going to talk about some of the mindsets that are so critical for entrepreneurs to be thinking about throughout their business growth and scale journey. Leadership Junkies podcast, where we explore leadership, business, and personal growth to help you grow your business and live a richer life. We're your hosts, Jeff Dischwitz
and Craig Matthews. We believe that leaders have to put their people first. And if you don't have time to grow your people, then you're not leading.
Get ready for conversations that will challenge your thinking and help you transform your leadership and your business.
Welcome to your bigger business and bigger life.
We are thrilled to be back here, and we've got a guest coming to us from the UK. Jan Cavell is with us, and she is the entrepreneur of entrepreneurs. She has spent a few decades running and building micro and small businesses, and she knows very well the challenges that entrepreneurs face. In fact, like many entrepreneurs with similar stories, you know, starting one business from her kitchen table when her children were small and turning it to a multi-million dollar business. She has a lot of entrepreneurial experience focused on growth and scaling. In fact, she's got a book coming out just in a few weeks, around July 6th here in the US. The book is called Scale for Success. And we are so looking forward to the wisdom that Jan is going to bring us today. So welcome, Jan.
Thank you so, so much, both of you. I'm so chuffed to be here. It's lovely to spend some time with you both.
Good to have you.
So Jan, give us a little bit of your backstory.
My backstory was really that I came to entrepreneurship very accidentally, in that I came from a sort of age and background that young ladies were brought up to get married, you know, sort of not quite Scarlett O'Hara, but, you know, not far off. And, you know, so I wasn't particularly well educated or anything because it wasn't considered important. And I was doing my sort of stint of freedom in my late teens and early 20s, and quickly discovered I hated working for other people. And so I set about working for myself and got a sort of taste of running small businesses, be it me or me and a friend, and doing strange things. A lot of it built around selling. And then I did get married. And as you rightly said, when I found myself a single mom again, or divorced and therefore a single mom, and with two small kids, I had to do something. And that went back to me thinking, I can sell, and I can sell while I looked after children, and maybe earn a living. I didn't have grand plans because I didn't really know anything about business or entrepreneurship. It wasn't even very sort of well known in the way it's been since then with so much exposure. But, you know, I just was thinking food on the table when I started. But because of supply chain problems, you know, I ended up starting a manufacturing side to keep a long story short. And so the thing grew unexpectedly into this sort of 40 plus people, two small factories thing over a period of time, which was all learning curve for me. So many mistakes. So, you know, so much ignorance going on.
Wow. And what was the product that you sold?
Furniture.
Oh, okay.
I've sold it to interior designers. It wasn't really that I knew anything about furniture, it must be said. But I was looking for something that was a repeat of offer that I could, you know, tie up a client in the sense of giving them service and, you know, general reliability and whatever they wanted, touch their pain points. And, you know, therefore make it easier. The last thing I wanted was somebody ringing our doorbell with children around on a Saturday morning saying, can you make me a chair, you know? So it had to be trade.
Right.
So someone, I can't remember who once said that you begin with the end in mind. I don't remember who said that, but I'm going to begin with the end in mind here and start at the end of the story, because you've got a book coming out, and what I'm curious about is the title is Scaling for Success. And that's a word that's thrown around a lot. So can you share with us, what does scaling mean to you? Because scaling comes later in a business typically. But talk about what is scaling to you.
I think, I mean, the word scaling has, or scale or scaling has, it sort of really changed, hasn't it? Or certainly in the UK, in that it was all about businesses getting funding for fast growth at one time. And now it's sort of expanded into companies that want to grow sustainably, if I can say that without stuttering. You know, sort of a steadily, sustainably, and with a long-term growth future. So I think it's expanded from that idea that it's a company that's getting serious investor or VC money involved. Though, of course, often it does take that.
So to get to the point of that's the end, you work with a lot of entrepreneurs. You've been an entrepreneur. I said, you know, most entrepreneurs don't think about scaling at the beginning, but do they need to? And is that something you talked about to them early on in their building of a business?
I think it's, I mean, as I say, I didn't, you know, so I come from an approach of somebody who didn't and regrets it in many ways. I think you want to start a business in an ideal world with a clear view of why you're doing it and where you want to go to. And what the end goal for you is, which may be not scaling it. It may be that, you know, you just want to stay you and your best mate doing the corner store or whatever. But that's fine as well. I'm a huge fan of micro businesses. You know, goodness knows I love doing it. You know, equally, if you want to scale, I think it's important to put in those preparation steps pretty early on. I mean, maybe sort of, you know, your half a mil turnover, something like that. You want to start thinking, I've got to prepare for this and take some time to do it. Because a lot of businesses, myself included, just wander into it and keep on growing and then find they're riding this colossal wave of how to control mess and, you know, get into trouble with it. It's so easy to do that.
Is that where you bring in professional management, or are you talking about maybe as you're building your team, you're also thinking about systematizing the things that you have there?
Lots of things. Both of those things, very definitely, absolutely. The systems, yes, certainly, because otherwise you're not going to be able to expand. I mean, in my growth, that, you know, I remember going very, very fast at one stage and finding, as I say, mid-40s people. And it was because we weren't systemized enough. It was very strange because we had these buildings and there were more people because we hadn't been coping with work. But lots of people standing around going, what am I supposed to be doing? Oh. And we were still, you know, lost in meeting targets and things because we hadn't got the systemization at that stage. You know, so yes, on that front, definitely.
Gotcha.
And on management, absolutely. Because I think the thing is, I mean, you know, you start off, you know, been there, did it. And we had a great atmosphere. It was wonderful. You know, we had right up to sort of 15 maybe staff on the team. And everybody knew what they were doing. You know, everybody was having great fun, and you know, we could all negotiate the problems together. And it was great. And I knew everybody very well, you know, and I think at that stage, I hope I did a good job of looking after them and fighting in their corner. And and they certainly fought in mine. You know, when you get past that stage, and obviously I'm really keen to know what you guys think, because you're the experts, but I don't think you can line manage in that way much past that number. So unless you bring other really good managers in, you're going to start to lose contact. You're going to start to be overwhelmed. There are going to be people on your team you don't know very well and may not be buying in. And the whole thing is going to get, at best, unwieldy, at worst, real chaos and disaster. So that's my thought. Yeah, very definitely. You know, but again, it's planning. You can wander up to, you know, the top of Mount Everest and you find yourself at the top there, but you'll come down again if you're not putting the steps and prepping for it.
So, Jan, let me ask you a related question. And it's something that I missed, frankly, in my business, because I'm, as Craig knows, I'm very precise with words, and this is one where I wasn't. And I tended to use growth and scalability interchangeably. I don't anymore. So do those mean different things to you? And how do you work in the businesses differently based upon growth goals versus scale goals?
I think a scalability, I mean, growth just means getting bigger, me. And scalability means the ability to take it right up if you want to, because you can, I mean, for example, with your systems, you know, or yeah, say your management, you're starting to get a pyramid in place that you can expand and line manage. I'm making hand gestures way off camera. That's very silly. But I know what I mean. But, you know, you can start carrying on, you know, by the delegating system or whatever, you know, system you set up, so that it can go on growing. You know, and equally on a sales and marketing side, you've got to have enough market there that it's got to go to any size or to a substantial size, whereas growth could mean enough market that you're going to be 25% up or 10% up even next year. You know, so I think we're talking some growth to huge growth with scalability.
It's interesting because, as I said, that's something I missed for a long time, because I kept focusing on growing my business and wasn't thinking about scaling the business.
Yeah.
And the growth, frankly, is easier to achieve than scale. So I think it's an important distinction for people who are getting into business. And I loved what you said about, you got to know why you're getting into business. And can we talk more about that? Because I heard you say, like, why am I getting this business? But what do I want out of this business? Mm-hmm. And what kind of business do I want? And what kind of life do I want with this mm-hmm. business? I think are so many questions that aren't answered. So talk about how you work with entrepreneurs on those questions.
Well, I think, you know, again, you find people and to especially people, excuse me, who like you, like me, wandered into growth without knowing about scalability. And, you know, they get themselves to a certain size, whereas actually the business has become a nightmare. They get stuck, you know, and they don't want to get rid of it because they put all the years in. But they're thinking, where do I go from here? I don't think this is sellable, or I don't know how to go forward. And was this what I signed up for? But it's my job, you know, and what would I do if I didn't have it? And, you know, that gets to be a very miserable existence. And it's so contrary to why that people start businesses, you know, that you're tied into something, which is exactly not the freedom that you set out to get. You know, so I think it can be very, it's very easy to take a wrong path and end up feeling trapped.
Well, there you're identifying one. You jumped right to the next question on my mind. We talk here a lot about what we can do to get to success, but what are the obstacles to success? Like you said, you got trapped. You didn't have clarity. What are some of the things you see and work with entrepreneurs, especially early on, to watch out for that's going to get in their way?
Wow. My strength was sales and marketing, because I had at least had some experience in it. So I was able to capitalize and learn about that faster than anything else. So I guess I'm going to start there. I think people are often weak on knowing their market and knowing whether there's actually enough scope there to grow. And it's either that they know it well and they go crazy selling, which to some extent I did, and then can't produce the damn stuff or whatever. Minor disadvantage. Or alternatively, they do everything right. They put all these people in place and systems in place, and then they can't get the orders because they haven't sussed their market out and they haven't really nailed their market differential point. Which is so important. We're so crowded now, you have to really stand out from the clients. So I'd say that's probably mistake number one, because if you haven't got any sales, you're not going to get very far.
Wow, that is a brilliant statement, Jan. That's a big wisdom bomb. So when you're talking about that, it's rather interesting, because I've seen different aspects of growth. I've seen some people grow their sales and then have to scurry to finish, the back end to make sure that they can deliver. Kind of like when Dollar Shave Club had their viral video, and then they had to scramble to actually fill orders.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have people who build out everything. They're trying for perfection. They get this great infrastructure set up, and then they go to sell and they realize, the market doesn't want what we have.
Yeah.
So where's the balance in there?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you actually said something so key, because saying if the market doesn't want what we have, because people don't check that. They're convinced, we've got this marvelous product, so everybody's going to love it. But of course, it isn't about that. It's whether people want it. If they're not interested in your product, they're interested in their problem. That's what it comes down to. And people mistake the two. I have so often come across people arguing with me, but there's something wrong with their business, there's something wrong with their sales thing or whatever, because their product is so marvelous, but they've made no sales, so their product ain't that marvelous.
Sure, you don't want to call your book Your Baby Is Ugly?
Yeah, I should have done, shouldn't I? I'm not that title.
Well, that you raise an interesting question there about the market. And let's talk about the timing issues, because so many people think that, you start a business and it's an overnight success. And most of us know that isn't true, even in some micro businesses, but especially on businesses that are scalable, that they may not have, the market may not want what you have today, but they don't understand it yet. And do you have the wherewithal to get there and to build that? A quick story. I was with some friends this week for dinner, and he was telling me that many, many decades ago, and I don't know the years, he was living in Las Vegas, and one of his friends came to him and said, I have this brilliant idea. We're going to set up a system to bottle and sell water. And my friend said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. All I can do is get it out of a faucet. And he says, that's probably the decision I would make differently today, because he couldn't see it.
No.
And when they started, I said, did he get off to a fast start? He said, of course not, because people thought the same thing I did, but he saw the possibility. So speak to the idea of time in entrepreneurship, not just ideation and execution, but time.
I think you're absolutely right. And that can be luck as well. Obviously that, but your water story is sheer genius and was properly planned. My own experience was not, it was luck. that I was at a point where interior design was just taking off when I started as a actual general public sort of thing. Okay, you know, there were programs like Changing Rooms going on. I don't know if you have Changing Rooms in the States, but interior design programs anyway, for the first time. And they were talking about, you know, that painted furniture, and that was becoming fashionable. Lacquers were coming back from the 30s, and you know, which was great for me, because not knowing anything about furniture and not knowing much about design or anything else, you know, it was going to be cheap and cheerful to get some MDF, which I'd come across, and get people to paint it. But of course, you know, I met from an enormous resistance from people who were making it with any skill, because it was still considered in the making world cheap and nasty and chipboard. And, you know, we're craftsmen, don't you? You know, we're making wood, and, you know, so you can't do that. But, you know, it was a gradual fight, because we were on the crest of a wave. We were one of the first people by lark to be starting to offer that sort of furniture, and particularly made to order in the UK.
Now, that's essentially what IKEA does, right?
Yeah, if you like. Yeah, we were doing an upmarket, expensive, bespoke service.
Okay, gotcha. So laminated. Yeah. So okay, gotcha.
Within this, I want to, maybe it's going back a little bit. You were talking about sales and marketing, and you've mentioned a passion you have for micro businesses. I'm curious, do you typically see the sales and marketing gap in micro businesses as much as you do in other size businesses?
Yes, I think so. You know, because very many people launch into micro businesses because it's their passion, you know, and without probably doing their research, they might be doing it in a spare time, or you know, have got so convinced and they haven't consulted and they haven't got other people involved, which is fair enough. But they have, most of all, they haven't researched. And, you know, so they do go into something without knowing whether it's going to sell or not. But, you know, if you're launching a bigger business and you're putting some degree of money into it, you know, you really should have the sense to do your research. And it tears me to say that, having made as many mistakes as I did. So I'm not holding it against you if you've got no sense. But in an ideal world, you should definitely do more research about your market if you're going to put any money into it, which you can get away without doing often enough if you're a micro business.
I think the other side of it is, it's with the internet and having an online business, you can actually do a lot more in that long tail. So for example, a ferret toys company can make $2 million in its first year, but it's tightly focused, right? And it's for those people who really want that. Now, if you try to do that as a brick and mortar, you're going to fail because you don't have enough people around you.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the market has just been revolutionized by the amount we're using the internet, and even more so with COVID. Yeah. You know, it's completely changed. And, you know, whereas my career was spent in very, very bricks and mortar, I mean, there was an internet out there and we did have a website, but, you know, it wasn't. I mean, that was important to have got, you know, the presence and for it to look right. But, you know, we still had a hardcore brochure that we sent out and all that sort of thing. You know, and it was, as I say, a broad section of clients, broad section of things we did. So yeah, but yeah, this niche thing which you can really hone into, you know, bar the net and really access those clients in the niche is a fantastic opportunity.
One of the things I'm curious about, Jan, of where you see it and how you help these entrepreneurs or business owners, is in the services businesses, particularly, I'm going to call it broadly, consulting of some sort. That market has exploded the last 10 years and has really exploded even more the last year, frankly. I mean, my friends, I mean, I'm a coach, consultant, you are, we joke about, you know, I think it's up like 10 times. Everybody who either lost their job or they got, you know, they got the opportunity to work flexible hours. They said, this is really cool. Now I'm a consultant. How do you see sales and marketing issues with those types of businesses? And what are you telling business people who want to do that today about how to really get it right?
It's interesting, actually. I mean, I was on Skype or one of the lives with a friend who's a coach and consultant this morning, and talking about how she could develop her channels, and a seminar I just watched equally before I was speaking to her, because I wanted to sort of check out some current thinking. And the seminar that I was watching was Roger James Hamilton and Daniel Priestley on exactly this point of how, you know, so this is up to date and fresh and probably much more accurate than anything I could say to you. But they were saying that they both use a very similar format, that they rely on very much on getting a book out. Not in the way I've done that actually at all, but self-publishing, and you know promote that, give away loads, and then put encourage people from building that relationship in the book to come online to their website and do an analysis of some sort,
yeah,
you know, that hooks them further and thinks, you know, yeah, I have got this problem, and they can then personalize the answers that they, the coaches and consultants can then personalize the responses back and really firm up finally that relationship. And that makes total sense to me. But, you know, you view it as a complete process.
So it's basically an online sales funnel that may have like a quiz or some sort of questionnaire up front.
Yeah. But it all starts with a book. So the book is your biggest selling tool in establishing both your authority and rapport, which, as I say, is nothing to do with mine, because I didn't I didn't go self-publishing, and I can't. I've got loads of copies away, and it wasn't actually why I wrote it anyway. But yeah, I can see that it's if you're going to build a big career as a coaching consultant, it probably is a very good piece of advice, and it does add to your authority and all that stand out. Because again, they were saying that, and I'm sure it's true, and I see it myself, that there are so many, as you say, this huge growth of coaches and consultants, which means less people in work, which means a bigger bum fight for the coaching and consulting jobs inevitably. So an awful lot of people are sitting there with an empty sales card.
So then the book is your high-end business card.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors.
If you enjoy the Leadership Junkies podcast and you want to grow your leadership, we have a new course for you called Become a Confident Leader. In this course, we will share some of the keys to becoming more confident in your leadership and also to become more impactful. Go to cardavera.com/confident to find out more. See you on the inside. Welcome back.
So I'm curious, I think this will lead to some real insights on the entrepreneur, how you work with the entrepreneurs. So people are coming to you, they want help, right?
Yeah.
What are they typically coming, what are they coming to you with? And then how are you helping them?
They are, I mean, yes, good question. I mean, it's an interesting one, because I've morphed it on this one, because when I retired, I was going to retire. And then I went back to my writing and started talking to other entrepreneurs. And I thought, oh, I better do, you know, I'm talking to people, I better do a coaching course. And I started to try and coach as per the book once I've become an accredited coach. When I say as per the book, that's the manual on coaching, not as opposed to what I've written about. But I found on the whole that I wasn't probably the greatest coach. I find it terribly difficult, and that's my wrong, to stand back when somebody's missing a, you know, crystal clear answer to keep my mouth shut, you know. So I make totally a much better consultant.
Jeff is much better at that than I am. Jeff's an excellent coach.
I'm so pleased. It's not just me, because I just find it,
I'm more of a consultant than a coach.
Definitely.
Well, there are times, and in fact, it's funny you say that. This was an interjection this week with a friend, but I was in coaching mode with them.
Yeah.
And I think I had asked 3 or 4 times a question, all designed to help them get something that I could see. Okay. I could see it, but I really wanted them to see it. But after 3 times, I just said, okay, let me just offer this to you. Because I'm thinking I have patience up to 3 times. But, and then I also realized, by the way, and this is the thing for me in coaching, that often some of the most important things we need to learn, that I need to learn, are so hidden from me that I need that person to tell me. And what I'll do a lot in the coaching, as I did there, is here's what I'm seeing. And then, I'll usually say, how does that land with you?
Yeah.
They'll say, and in this case, he said, yeah, that is what it is. I do not want to admit that. So he was willing to hear it. And sometimes if I say it and it doesn't land, it means I just missed it. But that is the difference. I'm going to lead with the questions and only as a last resort make the statement.
Yeah. Like I say, I'm a huge admirer of people who coach really well. I think it's an extremely clever skill, but I do think it's probably not mine. Whereas as a consultant, I can be of some value.
Yes. So as the people who are coming to you, I want to go back and just better understand that. Are they coming and saying, I want to start a business, help me get it right to start it? Or I've started the business, I've got struggles, help me with the struggles? Or are they more so they're struggling with something?
Okay. Yeah. You know, or they're just, you know, they say rather very typically, they'll say, you know, we're at a stage we think we ought to have a NED or you have non-exec directors. Is that sort of similar over there?
We don't use that word.
Right. Somebody on the board is an outside director or advisor.
Yeah, we call them advisors. So an advisory board.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, of course, that's how you put it. Sorry, my stupid. You know, we think we've got to the stage where we need one of those without really actually knowing why they need it, what they need.
You know, I need help, and therefore I need.
Yeah, you know, it's a good starting point. The chances are they don't necessarily, but, you know, they're just beginning to feel, you know, that things are getting a bit big, but their way isn't that clear. You know, and to be honest, a few sessions, they probably don't need. You know, a full-on, or from ones I've spoken to on the whole, don't actually need that, which is fine because it's not necessarily what I'm looking to do. But what they do need is a bit of clarity on where they're going, you know, and then when you can, you know, you can chat and put forward ideas, you know, tactfully, hopefully, but not in full coaching mode, you know, then you can get them to think about a bit clearer about what their goals are and what steps they need to take next, and, you know, come up with ideas as to how they're going to share it or where they're going to look for their team or whatever they're not seeing, you know, and what they need to think about, because unless you've gone through it, you don't know all the things you need to think about.
I'm really curious, Jan, how often are you running into entrepreneurs, business owners that really don't have an answer to that question? I think I find, including with myself, like that simple question, where are you going? It just lands and I see it's like deer in headlights. Well, let me show you my to-do list. Let me show you my goals. I said, no, I get that, but where are you going?
I love that. I think they don't realize that goals aren't a to-do list. Goals are a to-do list, but they're not, you know, where you're going. I think that distinction, which I've just messed up, is really, really important because it is two different things. And I would say to you, the honest answer to that is probably maybe one in 50 actually really know where they're going.
That's a small number, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. It's a real small number.
So you know, one thing I always like to ask with our guests, Jen, we have so many people that come on, whether they've built a business, whether they're a coach or consultant, it's uniform. Talk about the importance of mindset as an entrepreneur or business owner. And to what degree do you see that? And to what degree do you work with folks around what we're calling mindsets right now?
I think it's absolutely vital. And I think we sort of know that. But the problem is, I think there are two problems to do with this. One is that as you grow, you know, everything becomes so full on, the problems become so full on, you're pulled this way and that, you're trying to, you know, run this much bigger team, you're learning lots, you know, it's full on. And, you know, at the same time, you're expected to be the Superman to your team. You know, we all know that you've got to do this fantastic job looking after your team and, you know, put yourself on the, where do you get into it? You know, where is there space for you? And I think as entrepreneurs, we're very bad, or many, many people are very bad at looking after themselves because they think it should be all about doing the right thing. You know, they've got their customers are king, their people are king. You know, but where are they? You know,
I'm the king.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, they ought to be really the eighth, you know, but without them, they're no business. But you know, we don't think like that. And in my writing mode, I've done a fair bit of research on entrepreneurs and mental health because it fascinates me. And, you know, the figures of proper full-on research from people I've talked to are staggering, not just the damage of mental health to entrepreneurs, but also actually the fact that I think it's something like 73-75% of entrepreneurs have some sort of mental health issue, be it depression or ADHD or whatever, and a lot of them, equally high proportion, have had some sort of trauma in childhood, which they've probably coped with very well. I mean, it could have been a financial trauma in their parents' lives or a divorce or whatever. And they appear to have coped with it and built up resilience. And, you know, we'll do this, we'll power things through things. But it's all, you know, we've got to be Superman mode. And, you know, not actually looking after themselves at all. So, you know, sooner or later, you get to Armageddon because nobody can keep going without a self-care forever.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I see so many people that burn out. And it's really sad to see that. I do ask, though, in your research, do you find that people who have the mental health are more drawn towards entrepreneurship or entrepreneurs tend to develop these things over time?
I think both. I think, you know, yes, there's definitely a higher level to start with of, you know, tendencies to these mental health issues in entrepreneurs. And, you know, in some ways it makes them stronger. But also, of course, it does make them more vulnerable as well. And that's, of course, why, you know, we've seen such an appalling, you know, session of suicides in Silicon Valley and, you know, and so on. There are many high-profile figures who've turned to booze or drugs or whatever as a coping mechanism. You know, yet on the surface, they've been partying and hugely successful and, you know, having a great time. But they're struggling. And, you know, it's tough. It's really tough.
It's also lonely. Unless you have another group of entrepreneurs in a similar level, it can be very lonely being in that place.
Very, you're so right. One of the things I recommend people now to do is develop a group of peers, who are friends, you know, with sort of maybe three or four who meet on a regular basis, but you can brainstorm each other's problems in complete confidence. Right. But, you know, they above anybody else are the people who are going to understand how lonely it is and give you that support against that loneliness.
Yeah. So Jeff, I guess, is part of masterminds. Do you see it that way, Jeff?
Oh, absolutely. That's one form of it. I think it can be that. It can be more structured environments. It's certainly, I'm going to call them differently supportive friends, because a lot of time, you know, I need some groups of friends who are just going to be there. Mm-hmm. I also need those groups of friends who are willing to be really honest with me.
Yeah.
Tell me things. So I need a little of all of it. And I want people who challenge me. And I think that's, you know, we all need to seek that, those kinds of different mini or micro, I'll use your word, micro communities as opposed to micro businesses, micro communities that of support. Jan, you raise a really interesting question. I want to go a little deeper on. You use the word resilience. And that is a word that I would say really was not, and it may not be yet, but it was not mainstream in the business conversation leadership until probably the last 5 or 6 years. And I think it's a very confusing concept. And with, give me a moment here to feed the story. You were talking about someone coping. You kept saying coping and becoming resilient. And what I envisioned was, I actually thought about my father. I think this is an analogy. My father, God, 1995, how long that ago was, he was determined to have a tumor in his brain. It wasn't malignant. It was very large, though, and they were able to take it out. But he had some physical impacts that he still has today. And I said, boy, it was so large. Did that grow quickly? And they said, no, he's probably had this for 10 or 15 years. And I said, how did he not have any symptoms? And they said, oh, we guarantee you he had symptoms, but he adapted to those symptoms. So I think of that and say, was he resilient? Not in a healthy way. He hoped and he adjusted, but he wasn't really resilient in a healthy way. And I think I do like where we're going with resilience in this idea. It's not just getting through things. It's navigating them differently. So what are you seeing in that, and how does that show up in your work?
Gosh, well, you know, I mean, firstly, I think I'm right in saying that we've got the US Army originally to develop a resilience whole principle of that's where it came from, of the military, should I say, US, who developed it originally to study communities and see how under pressure military communities, you know, began to cope and be more resilient with, you know, because inevitably with conflict for the military, they have to cope with all sorts of things and potential things which are even worse still. So I think they developed it originally, but you're right, it's spilled over into business, and I can still identify with that story you've just told, because in a much more minor way, I remember, I guess it was probably sort of halfway through the years I had the business, but I was doing the brochures, which we still had because we weren't that digital, and they were huge amounts of work. I mean, you were talking about a sort of 100-page brochure with, you know, the whole photographs and the specifics and everything else, and goodness knows how many designs, and I was the only person who did them. And as a little side thing to the rest of my leadership, because I wasn't very good at sorting out other people to help. So, you know, this took some months, as you might imagine, and this mammoth job. And, you know, but it was necessary because clients expected, you know, a new brochure every year or 18 months or however often we did it. And I felt fine. You know, I got this thing done. And then there was just a price list to do. And I started thinking, not very well. Oh, anyway, I need to do the process. And the night that went down, I ended up doubled up, and I had massive stones in my gallbladder, and which had obviously been there the whole way through, but I had to get that brochure done, so I wasn't feeling them. So, yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Very unhealthy.
Well, and I think that's one of the main reasons we get to that number you threw out earlier of the 73 to 75% mm-hmm. folks dealing with some sort of mental health challenge mm-hmm. that now some of it can be, and I don't mean that, you know, they might have something genetic, et cetera. It could be chemical. However, it gets ignored, it pushed aside, I push through it.
Absolutely. You
know, and I know that's, I don't know the other cultures as well. In the US, that is the culture, especially for men.
Yeah.
Yep, yeah. I got this. I just push through everything. And I know I have that gene and I have to watch out for it.
Oh, you can't ask for help, Jeff. That's not allowed.
Right, I know. I know. And it's as much as I know that, it's still hard.
Yeah.
Because there's an old story. Right. There's an old message. And some of it's training. It's how I have trained. And I joke about it sometimes. Like I talk about my dad. People will say, Jeff, are you just like an overcomer? I go, yep, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
I learned it from my dad. Something's in your way. You find a way, which is a great thing, but I can do it in a really unhealthy way. Mm. I can sacrifice myself, my health, my energy, my sleep, my mental state, all of that to get to this destination and say, oh, I won. At what cost?
Yeah.
It's like kind of going into the,
No, I agree. I so agree. I would just go, you go ahead. I just would have to say, I agree. It's absolutely spot on.
I was just thinking of, you know, when you go to the amusement park and you shoot the gun and knock down the things and you get that little prize, right? The money that you spend getting that little prize is so not worth it. You could just go buy it for much less. And in the same way, we ruin ourselves oftentimes when we could easily go get some additional help, just ask somebody or hire, you know, a contractor to help us out.
That's such a good analogy. I might nick that one.
So Jan, I love questions, and you've already offered at least one question that you typically ask entrepreneurs, which is like, where are you going? Or some version of that. What are some other questions that you regularly ask the entrepreneurs, business owners to help them, support them?
I think, you know, well, firstly, and you know, just sticking to that whole picture of where you're going, you know, is what you want out of it. Because I think growth is very oversold at the moment, you know, in the nicest possible way. You know, they may be really happy with their tiny business. It may be making lots of money. You know, I certainly never made as much money with 40-odd staff as I did with 15. You know, but we've got to grow because it's the thing to do, and that's clever. And, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, so what do you want out of it? And
it is, have, you know,
are you going to be better off for it?
That is such a good point. It's not about what everybody else says that it should be. It's about what you really want. And it's tough sometimes to remove your ego from that situation and say, oh, okay, it's not about when I get together with my buddies or my friends and talk about what's going on. It's about how it makes me feel every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think my weakness was that I was sales oriented. So for me, you know, that kick of getting another 100,000 sales or whatever was just too exciting. It must be right thing to do with, you know, without ever thinking of where it was heading or anything else.
So many people wish they had that sales gene.
Yeah, but you have to have the rest of it too.
Yeah.
Well, I love that last question because it reminds me of someone that Craig and I met 4 or 5 months ago. He's a longstanding business owner. I think he's in the midst of retiring now, and he often teaches courses at a college and about entrepreneurship, and students will ask him, you know, like what should they think? How should they do this? And this question he throws out to them regularly is, yes, get clear on what you want, but what are you willing to give up to have that? Because as much as I'd like to believe that I can have a lot, I know I can't have everything, and there's going to be a trade-off somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for me to understand what might I have to give up to achieve that, and then decide, am I willing to give that up?
Yeah.
If not, I need to go a different direction right now versus getting there and saying, oh my God, how did this happen?
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, this again is a worry with the drift, because, you know, you may be dreaming of a massive business. And for example, there's an entrepreneur, I interviewed several entrepreneurs for my book, and there's one I'm thinking about particularly here for a second. And, you know, he was absolutely focused on having a hugely successful business from his early 20s. And he wanted to do it straight away and have this business so that for a period of time and then sell it for a mint, you know. And he did it, but, he was still in his early 30s with a great deal of money. You know, it was a multinational, big in America, still going, you know, big in the UK business. you know, fantastic. But he was entirely focused on a game plan of growth from, you know, day one that was going to take them to that point of exit in that period of time. You know, and that's a whole different thing. You know, he knew exactly where he was going to go, and he was prepared to give up the things he gave up for that period of time in return for being able to do what he wanted and for, with his family for the rest of his life.
Well,
Yeah, I do have to say this. I'm curious if you run into this. I probably have heard it three times this week already. I think that I call it one of the most dangerous trap phrases, which is some version of, well, this is only an issue for now. This is only the thing that's going on now. Like this mindset of, yeah, everything's a mess. I'm not spending time with my family. I'm not taking care of myself. I'm running 100 miles an hour. I'm doing 100-hour weeks, but this will pass. And my belief is nothing passes until I change things.
Right.
To change that path. So do you hear that a lot?
Oh, absolutely.
And what are your thoughts on that?
I did it myself. So, yes. yes, I hear it from other people. You know, and interestingly, I mean, going back to that same entrepreneur, he didn't do it. You know, he was really strict with the hours he worked. He wouldn't work at a weekend. He wouldn't encourage his team to be work at the weekend or speak to them or bother them at a weekend. He actually worked school holiday, school term times, and kept himself at such a peak that he was so full on the rest of the time when he was at work, but he achieved what he achieved. But, you know, he didn't ruin his life as we're conditioned to do, to achieve that. You know, so it's this curious thing that we believe we've got to run ourselves into the ground if we're going to be successful.
Yeah. Whose game are you playing, right? If you can choose to play your own game, you set the rules, you define what your structure is, what your work hours are, how much you can make. A lot of people don't realize that you can do that.
No. And I think that's one thing they don't feel they've got right in some way. As an entrepreneur, maybe, you know, maybe it comes back to mental health again, that we haven't quite got the self-value enough that, you know, to think that we're worth it. Or the conditioning that, you know, everybody else has got to come first. You know, if you're always the one who stays behind and says, no, you go home, you know, but the fact remains is, you know, you're going to burn out sooner or later if you're always the one who works till midnight.
Jan, this is so wonderful, so rich and diverse. I want to wrap up with a closeout question with you, and then we'll get into some of the cool things going on for you. We've talked about a lot of different topics, ways you work with entrepreneurs, ideas. What's kind of your parting word of wisdom for entrepreneurs, that thing they really need to hear today?
Don't do anything because other people are doing it because it's right for you.
Yeah, so good.
That is sweet and to the point. So thank you for that, Jan. We want to make sure we spend a few minutes talking about exciting things going on for you. So what in particular would you like to highlight for our listeners today?
Well, I guess, I mean, for me at the moment, I'm very involved in my book coming out in the States, which, you know, it's when I say that, there's it's slightly surreal thing for me to say. It was a childhood dream for me to write, and life came along and it got sidetracked. And then I started doing it as a stress reliever, actually, when I had a business, writing digital occasions, it was great. I got sucked in, you know, out there in the zone, in the flow, and everything else could go away. Nothing else worked as well as writing. But so, you know, when I retired, I thought, well, you know, I'd love to have a go at a book. And it was only about halfway through, I thought, what do I do with this? You know, I don't know anything about self-publishing. You know, I probably should get it published, but I haven't a clue why or how. And, you know, as Extreme Lot would have it, the wonderful Bloomsbury Publishing, who are rather serious stuff, were kind enough to take me on, which, you know, still dazzles me. And so it came out in the UK in February and is coming out in Australia and the US in July, which is super amazing. And I'm very, very lucky to be fulfilling a dream.
I'll tell you, so, it is amazing when you actually see your book on the bookshelves at the bookstore. It's like,
I bet.
I remember I was on vacation one day after writing my first book and saw it on the shelves. And I was like, hey, Julie, you know, I called my wife over. Hey, here's my book.
Yeah, I'm going to have to mask up and venture out and go and have a scan around, at least in the UK, I think, and have that experience.
Yeah.
So the book is called Scale for Success. It's coming out in the US on July 6th, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how can people, is it available on pre-order or people wait till the 6th if they're in the States?
No, absolutely. They can order it now. They can order it through Bloomsbury or through Barnes & Noble or through Amazon or any other good bookseller they choose. And so they will be one of the first to receive the copies when it becomes available on the 6th.
Awesome. And what is the best way for people to connect with you, Jan?
I would love to hear from any of your listeners who have any questions at all. And if they'd like to know more about me, they want to leap on my website, and that's jancavell.co.uk.
Right. And we always wrap up with a couple in this case, we're just going to grab one question here for you, one of our favorites. I want you to imagine you get a chance to have dinner with someone who's living. Who do you want to have dinner with? And what's the one question you're going to make sure you ask them?
I have had to think about this. And I think for me, probably right now in the world, I would be curious to have dinner with Jacinda Ardern. You know, because she is, as another woman, I mean, she's revolutionized a lot about leadership at a time where a lot of countries are having trouble with leadership, shall we say. And she's got New Zealand in hugely behind her, and yet she's really young, comparatively for a politician. You know, I want to know what made her, you know, what formed her is the word I'm looking for. So, yeah, I'd ask her, you know, what made her be the woman she is today.
Well, thank you for that, Jan, and thanks for being here with us today, and thanks for all the wisdom you've brought to our listeners.
My absolute pleasure. It's been a joy talking to you both.
If you enjoy the Leadership Junkies podcast and you want to grow your leadership, we have a new course for you called Become a Confident Leader. In this course, we will share some of the keys to becoming more confident in your leadership and also to become more impactful. Go to cartavera.com/confident to find out more. See you on the inside.
The world's best-known investor and Wall Street expert, Warren Buffett, once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.